today's special guest, Dr. Chris Martinson from Peak Prosperity and the new bestseller, Prosper. Dr. Chris Martinson, big economic researcher, futurist dealing with energy, resources, and I might add, one of our favorites, and that's natural health healing. Welcome, Dr. Martinson.
Why, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be back.
I'd like to start off, I think, with what we usually end the discussion with, this idea that maybe modern medicine has missed the boat on a few key areas, and that, and particularly when it has to deal with chronic health issues such as diabetes, Alzheimer's, so many diseases that people are terrified of, even cancer. We find that the mainline, the mainstream medical community has a really difficult time not only A, grappling with, but treating. And it seems to be as though there are a couple of components here that take more than just a magic bullet, that take more than just a magic elixir or panacea. Some of these things require entire lifestyle, dietary changes on really big scale, and it's doable, but within the context of modern society, it can be really challenging. And I'd like your thoughts.
Wow, where do I start? I have so many thoughts in this. This is an area I am increasingly researching and understanding and talking. And you know as well as I that you know, if you look at the large data for the United States, but you could extend this globally too, it's a pattern of increasingly poor health and health outcomes. Obesity, chronic issues, things that were really fringe problems a number of decades ago are now common. All sorts of food allergies. Where did these suddenly pop up? You know, just the obesity epidemic, on and on and on and on. There's clearly something wrong. And this is something we talk about in our new book, Prosper, is that 80% to 90% of almost everything that ails people starts and is treated in the kitchen. It begins with your nutrition. It begins with making sure that the things you're putting into your body are not hurting you, either directly because it's toxic, it's got pesticides, it's got herbicides, it's got mycotoxins, it's something like that, but even more indirectly because you're eating things that are constantly causing your body to go into a little bit of a panic, creates inflammation, starts fighting this invader you've eaten, and unfortunately fights the invader in things that look like the invader, which could be the linings of your blood vessels, it could be your nerves, it could be all kinds of things. So really, it begins there. You know, there is no magic pill. You don't go to the doctor and they cure you. It all begins with your lifestyle, your choices, the decisions you make. And really, there's nothing more important than what you put in your mouth every day.
A couple of things come to mind, and that is Hippocrates. You know, I know you know the father of modern medicine, beginning in the Greek era. We're echoing his thoughts here, and that is that let your food be your medicine. And your medicine be your food. If I walk into the doctor's office and I'm going to pay him $200 to sit down with him and tell him about my ailments and, you know, my swollen lymph nodes and things of that nature. I mean, the problem is, you know, you're eating the wrong things. You're not exercising enough, malnourished diet and depleted of the essential minerals and vitamins that should be in the soils. So much of this is not readily apparent. Much of it is beyond our some of it is beyond our control. I'm not going back to that doctor. I'm going to go to the doctor who says, no, this isn't your fault. You know, we have millions of people with the same problem. And here, you know, we're just going to put you on some chemotherapy. And that's going to just solve all your problems. In the meantime, your immune system is crushed, destroyed. And then when the invader does finally regain its strength, as does hopefully your body, your immune system is crushed, has no ability to fight. And that's why more than likely the longevity of most people who undergo these treatments rarely is beyond 5 years. We don't have to be afraid of this, but we have to take some responsibility. And once we do accept some responsibility, which I think the medical community is not willing to put on our shoulders, then you can formulate a plan of attack. Tell us more.
First, if you have a serious chronic issue of any kind, it could be cancer, it could be a metabolic disease, it could be an autoimmune disease, something, you know, Crohn's, diabetes, anything in those categories, you have the responsibility to start researching and understanding how you brought this upon yourself. And I know that sounds harsh, but it's absolutely true. Our bodies are amazing. They are fighting off billions, trillions of invaders every day, every second of the day, and that's what our bodies do. And so if we have a healthy baseline, that's how the body functions. When you become unhealthy, it means you're off of baseline, right? And so to me, the first thing to understand is that health isn't something we achieve. It's a place we exist in. Disease is a place we achieve. Unhealth is a place we accidentally get to. So all we want to do is return back to health. And so you're right. A lot of the frontline treatments, and I use that word loosely, in modern medicine either are masking the symptoms. Oh, you have an autoimmune disease. Here's your prednisone. Here's your constant steroid function, which is going to mask the symptoms for you. But it doesn't actually get at why you are having that autoimmune issue. Cancer. Oh, here, we're going to cut, burn, or poison you. These things, like, if you look at, if somebody said, Chris, I have a computer that was invented in 1940, I think you should look at it. It's awesome, state of the art. You're going to have to use this computer. You'd think I was nuts, right? But when you go for a modern dose of chemotherapy, whether it's cisplatin or something like that, those were invented in the 40s. It like, no progress. And so modern medicine does a lot of things really well. Listen, if I'm in a car accident, I have a heart attack, I'm going right there. But for other things, medicine is literally still stuck in the 30s and the 40s in some ways. It's one of the most regressive, least advanced areas of understanding that we have. And the thing is that if, you know, part two of the story is, yeah, take responsibility, start reading. You can find dozens, if not hundreds, of anecdotes of people who have actually cured their cancer, right? And there's not one pill here, like, oh, go here to Mexico and eat this one diet, you know, do the Gerson diet. Your cancer is going to be unique. Each one behaves a little bit differently. There's a lot of evidence out there. But there are people out there who have been absolutely 100% in remission for many, many years, no detectable cancer, because they didn't go down the cut, burn, poison route. And if you look at the people who do go on modern frontline chemotherapy, not including these new fancy ones that are actually using the immune system, those are a separate category, but I mean the old-time poisons, right, that just kill every cell that's dividing, kind of like a sledgehammer on an ant colony. If you look at those people who've gone through that chemo, in 10 years, how many of them are cancer-free? And the answer is like 3%. So if you said, hey, Chris, I've got this awesome stuff, it's frontline, you can go to a really fancy cancer center somewhere in the United States or Europe and fancy people and white doctors and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it has a 97% failure rate, I hope that we would say, well, maybe that's not actually the best strategy out there. And so there are other strategies, but it begins with people understanding really what the basis of the disease is, why it took off, and the ways in which you can actually fight these things, and we're getting understanding it. We know that some cancers need certain types of foods. They need a lot of glucose, or they need the presence of this factor, or they're really, really inhibited by having other things in there. We're learning all the time about, for instance, medical marijuana, in particular the cannabidiols or the so-called CBD part of that story, which is not the part that gets you high, right? That's the THC, but both THC and CBD interact with receptors in our bodies. We've got two types. They're everywhere. And a lot of cancers seem to have a really hard time living in the presence of these compounds. So that's an area that people could look to if they were interested in understanding that more. And again, we have data just is pouring in about the ways in which we can actively work with our bodies to support things. And I'll tell you what, medical science is one of the most regressive industries I know. It takes them forever to figure out something new or even to incorporate a new learning into their thinking. Here's a simple example. My daughter just had a pretty decent cut on the back of her hand, and we couldn't quite get it together ourselves, so we thought maybe it needed some stitches, and we go to the ER, and the nurse hands her some betadine and says, here, start washing that out. I'm like, whoa, time out. We've known for 2 decades that betadine inhibits wound healing, and it's not modern therapy, even remotely close. Nobody uses betadine anymore, right, on an open wound like that. But they did, right? How do they not know that? So really, I think, you know, for anybody listening, for anybody who's got a health issue or is interested in being healthy, it begins with educating yourself, because the so-called experts, frustratingly, in our medical community, don't either have the time or the inclination to really be current in what we know works.
And I'd just like to throw a few statistics so that people can visualize numbers that we can toss into the back of our heads. We're inundated with information today, overwhelmed. Some of these excellent points you've raised. You poll these cancer doctors, these oncologists, on their willingness to put themselves and their families through the same battery of, as you, I think, aptly note, you know, cut, poison, and burn. And of course, we're referring to surgery, which I'm not, I don't have a huge problem with in some cases, if it be a small nodule or something, or melanoma. So surgery may be in some cases, but the poison process, we're referring to chemo, doctors referring to chemo here, and he's referring to burn as radiation. Fewer than 80% in one study, and fewer than 90% would put themselves or their families. And the statistics you brought up, just say less than 3% really benefit. And there is some interesting peer-reviewed articles, if you want to take the time to, you know, in the literature, that show that really that's an overestimation, that it's closer to 0 to 0.5% of these treatments have helped anyone in the long term. And in general, I'll never forget listening to one brilliant oncologist who was in the field for almost 50 years. And he's on record here. You can find him online. And he said, you know, the best treatment for cancer is to live as far away from a cancer treatment facility as possible. This is a retired oncologist. I don't want people to think we're just harping on this because we're not anti-medicine. If you're in a car wreck, you know, there is no better place to be probably than some emergency room. Okay, they're gonna fix you up. That's what they do best, trauma. But when it comes to chronic disease, I mean, I'd rather go to a leech therapist or a bloodletting. Well, maybe we've covered this. Is there anything I've left out? I'm sure there's some topicality here that you'd like to wrap up this discussion with.
Well, this is just an increasing area of interest for me, and part of the work that I've done in the world is put the economy, energy, environment into a story. I'm starting to assemble a story around this, and it begins with my own life. You know, my own transformation of my own health really began with some of these things we're talking about. It began with really beginning to control what I'm putting in my body, and it ended with this idea. When I walk into a supermarket now, right, this is where all the food is, and you walk in and it's just 20 aisles of, you know, consumer bliss. I got to tell you, when I walk in those stores now, literally the whole middle of the store doesn't have anything in it I can eat. Like the whole middle. I have to walk around the edge. You know, there's like very little that's actually food out there that's worth eating at this point. And so it's getting increasingly difficult to really eat well. You have to put some effort into it. And it really begins with eating organic as much as you can for a variety of reasons, and mostly because of the Roundup used. And it begins with finding local sources of food and maybe even growing some of your own, all things that I've done.
Folks who, you know, don't have the time to digest all of this or are curious, functional medicine. I mean, Dr. Martinson here and myself, we're both interested in functional medicine. I think one of the founders in this area is Dr. Mark Hyman. Can't recommend enough his work. He I think, is just one of these living treasure troves of information. And just as the saying goes, physician, heal thyself, this is exactly what Dr. Mark Hyman did, and he documents it so well online in these quick little 5 to 7 minute, for those of us who just don't have the time, we're overwhelmed all the time from morning, you know, to night. Type in Dr. Mark Hyman at YouTube and he will blow you away. And he walks through the supermarket, just as Dr. Martinson pointed out here, until he gets to the produce section. And he gives some very real ideas, recipes and whatnot on what we have to do and change our mindset. And I agree with you. Roundup, I think, is just the tip of the iceberg. And you know, we've talked about this in the past, that what they've found is that what's happened to our food supply is that during the Civil War and over hundreds of years of large-scale growing, the ground, the resources there, not only is it depleted, but it's filled with arsenic, cyanide, and lead. And much of this came from these just early pesticides. And unfortunately, as you've pointed out, and so many others, Dr. Oz and others, and Dr. Hyman, when the soil's depleted, the plants search around for whatever they can find to make up for that, just like our bodies, incidentally. And they reach out to these nasty chemicals that we've put there, and they start to concentrate. And when they do, you know, it might take a pound of grain to make your loaf of bread, okay? And you've got concentrated heavy metals and nasty metals throughout. And guess what? Those same grains grains end up in the livestock. So the meat is the most dangerous place. That's where it accumulates at the highest levels because the feed is toxic. And I can verify this. Even our organic feed that we've tested here at my home had dangerously high levels of cyanide, which is the precursor to diabetes, the precursor to lymphoma, the precursor to almost every nasty disease, including fibromyalgia, and so many others of these chronic diseases. So I just hope folks will wrap their minds around what Dr. Martinson's brought up and check out Dr. Mark Hyman, Functional Medicine. You don't have to be afraid of these diseases if you really start to get the right information. Let's move on to topicality, Doctor, that folks are excited about and that our listeners are precious metals aficionados and they like the commodities sector. And I know you're watching oil, crude oil, and West Texas Intermediate crude closely.
Well, I am. And the summary of the commodity space at this point in time, it's signaling something that I think our stock market has not quite digested yet, to use that word again, is that we're in a massive global slowdown economically right now. This isn't a big surprise. One of the theories that we've been working with at Peak Prosperity a long time is goes by the name First the Fall. We think there's a big deflationary event coming. It's going to just sweep through a world awash in debt. It's going to be very, very damaging. It's going to hurt a bunch of people, economies, nation states. It could lead to conflict. It's going to be a fairly pronounced period of deflation. And by deflation, I don't mean, you know, the price of the car went down next week. Deflation is a monetary event. It means that not enough money and credit is being accumulated in the system or created in the system to support all the prior debts that have been accumulated in the system. And when deflations get started, they tend to feed on themselves. It means I can't pay you because, you know, my business has gone down. I have too much debt. I can't service my debt, so I can't pay you, and then you can't service your debt. And then, you know, on and on, and the daisy chain goes until all the excess debt is wiped out. And unfortunately, there's maybe $100 trillion of too much debt in the world. There's $200 trillion total. I think it needs to go away by about half. So first the fall, first this deflation comes, this really scares the central banks. And then they panic out, and this time they give money to Main Street, not Wall Street. And then we have the second part of this story, which is a very, very large inflationary event. So to your listeners, you know, this is going to take some patience, but here's the strategy for getting through this. What I'm saying is that paper claims, whether it's a stock, a bond, a derivative, even currency itself, those are going to essentially be proven to be worth the paper they're printed on or maybe less. And what's going to shine over the long term, of course, is real hard assets, tangible things, land, productive land in particular, timberland, farmland, good high-quality real estate, gold, silver, oil. These are the true forms of actual wealth. We've forgotten that for a little while as a country, maybe even as a species. That's what's coming back again. But first, we're going to go through a fairly significant financial panic where if we're measuring the price of things in dollars, it's going to be very difficult to sort of predict what's going to go where and why. But if we just forget about the dollars as the measuring stick for a minute, you know, the things I'm tracking more carefully now is the ratio of things that are real things to real things. You know, how many grams of gold per barrel of oil, how many barrels of oil per, you know, solid commercial real estate property, how many ounces of gold for an acre of land, things like that. Because the measuring stick, the currency itself, increasingly unreliable. I'm of the opinion, and our site is all dedicated to this idea that we just have way too many paper claims and not enough real production, and history is clear. All we have to answer at this point is who is going to eat the losses. And the bankers are being very diligent in making sure it's taxpayers, and you know, you're watching the fine people of Greece get absolutely crushed by the bankers laying the pain of their bad lending decisions on the people of Greece. People of Greece are starting to figure it out. They got there a little late. They really should have taken things into their own hands a number of years ago. But this is where we are in the story. I wish we weren't here, but you know, we have just entirely too much debt in the system, and that's just on the economic side of the story. So yes, commodities are going to be a great place to be, but first we're looking for a lot more weakness.
Let's look at some of the statistics that some of the top pundits have brought up recently. You know, hat tip to Martin Armstrong, the forecaster, if you will, interesting documentary. He'll be on the show in a couple of weeks. He points out that there has never been an even one example of negative interest rates in over 5,000 years. We start talking about the anomalies that are popping up, which should, I think, be raising some red flags around the world with our policymakers and institutions, not to mention individual investors. There's one interesting anomaly, but here's another one. We had Dr. Paul Craig Roberts on the show I'd never even thought about, but it's obvious if you do. We all know there's about $250 trillion in interest rate-sensitive notional derivatives sitting on our domestic balance sheets here in our five or six top money center lending banks. Okay, so in other words, long story short, the banks have a huge debt problem. But if you look at the world GDP, which is roughly $76 trillion on an annual basis, everything produced by everybody on the globe, any one of those five or six banks has more than that much debt. If you can wrap your mind around that, I challenge the listeners to. And that, of course, is just a train wreck waiting to happen.
Well, it is. And, you know, the whole idea behind derivatives is that they're supposed to be these wonderful insurance policies, and on paper they are. You know, it says, oh, if the interest rate of this country spikes or collapses, I'm covered, you know, and therefore, because I'm covered, I don't have to carry any risk on my book. I don't have to set any assets aside. I don't have any margin I have to put there. I don't need any capital. I'm covered, right? Well, what we know about derivatives is they seem to be insurance policies that work until you need them. And then nobody wants to test them and find out if they can work, because of course they can't. And that's why the banking industry, we call this the Citi Amendment, worked very hard in a funding bill in December 2014, inserted what's called the Citi Amendment, which makes derivative claims between banks superior to depositor claims, meaning that if you have money at a big money center bank and they lose $1 trillion on bad derivative bets, that you the deposit holder are a source of funds to help make that bet whole. And the frustrating part about this is, of course, you know, the A, that it happened, but B, derivatives are a zero-sum game. So if Citi loses $1 trillion to J.P. Morgan, J.P. gets the trillion. Citi loses $1 trillion. Oops, we're going to have to go into the depositor funds at Citi to make up that shortfall, right? That's the frustrating part, because it's really a heads-we-win, tails-you-lose moment for the banks. That's what they've been doing, and it's one of the reasons, one of the many reasons, I am increasingly counseling people to just have as little to do with the banks as possible. If you have money in a bank, don't have it in one with a lot of derivatives on the books. You go to the Office of the Comptroller of Currency, it's OCC.gov. They have a quarterly report on derivatives. You can pull it up. It's a PDF. You go to a table about two-thirds of the way down, and it shows you the top 25 banks with the derivative exposure. Don't bank with them. That's been my rule.
First of all, I think it's great advice. Encourage everyone to do exactly as the doctors said. But I would just throw one proviso in here. What if they've devised even more sneaky ways, nefarious ways to inundate the system with this toxic debt? Because, you know, if you read Frank Portnoy's fiasco and so many other great reads since then, I mean, that was their number one job at his financial institution, was convincing gullible folks who needed to either make up a certain amount of money or were just desperate to have a higher return, promising the moon, and then before you know it just blows up their balance sheet. And this happened all over the West Coast, and it's happened all over the world since then. And not to mention, there's always the local banker, which more than likely has next to none or next to zero toxic debt on its balance sheet. So there are some alternatives there, and nothing beats hard assets, I guess, as far as liquidity goes. And maybe that's a good segue into wrapping things up here today. Our current game plan here for 2016 includes a surprising number of increases, or at least an extent to which the Fed will raise rates. Most of my guests just disagree with us. They're convinced that rates stay at zero or negative forever. But I'm sorry, the numbers are screaming for at least 100 basis points before the end of 2016. So under that scenario, we're concerned that commodities will experience continued pressure, likely for the next 12 to 18 months, which should set the stage for, of course, a dollar rally. But then comes the recovery. Does this fit at all with your current thesis?
It does. But in recovery, the way we're looking at it is the recovery is going to mean a lot of money gets scared at sitting in giant, giant pools, and it decides it doesn't want to be in this fraudulent paper world anymore. Where does it go? It's going to try and squeeze through some very narrow commodity doorways. And this has happened over and over again in history. People become fascinated with things, and they want tangible assets, and then they become fascinated with paper, and the pendulum ticks and talks back and forth. So we think we're at the apex of the swing of the fascination with paper, and we're about to just sweep back towards things. And, of course, that will be aided by a little bit of rocket fuel from the Fed doing stuff with monetary policy. So that's the world we're in. We think, you know, you have to be positioned now for these swings. They're going to be violent. They're going to be disruptive. Who knows where they go? That's why Adam Taggart and I wrote this, our most recent book. It just got released a couple days ago. It's called Prosper. And it really helps guide people, not just in the financial sphere, but that financial capital is important, but it's just one form of capital. You and I were discussing a second form of capital, which is our living health. We have eight forms of capital that we think people should be truly diversified across all of those, and it includes things like social capital, the depth and trust built into your social network, very important determinant of both your current happiness and possibly your future survival. So we talk about all of these things because we think, you know, I got to be honest, we're coming into a time where analysis isn't going to help. Nobody can predict what's going to come next. We've never been here with negative interest rates. We've never been here with monetary policy. The world seems as about tense with each other as we have since 1911. There's just a lot of things out there that say, hey, probably a bad strategy to assume that everything's just going to recover and go back to how it was. We don't think that's very likely, but it's possible. But even if it does, some things that we would recommend people do make sense no matter which future comes. But if you're really diversified across all eight forms of capital, then you will be very thankful that you were should a number of future scenarios arrive.
Firstly, that sounds like must read. Prosper, the name of the book. We'll certainly have links up for our listeners and give you a good media blast. I'd love to see a copy of that. But I'd like to keep with a couple of important notes you've brought up. We have so many guests here on the show, so I'm privileged to hear the inner thoughts on air and both off air sometimes. The inner thinking of some of these fine financial minds, and it's quite a diverse background of folks. And notice a not disturbing, but a common theme that seems to run there, keeping in line with your comments, the ancient Chinese might have put it, I mean, may you never live in interesting times, or may you live in interesting times as a curse. And I'm afraid this really is interesting because it's really a dichotomy. On the one hand, you are right. Negative interest rates, no way. Total monetization of global debt around the world. Show me when that happened. But then on the other side of the spectrum, we're facing a dilemma where things are remarkably similar, and that is excessive profligate money spending and printing like mad, what led up to the French Revolution, commonalities there, plus you threw in there the deflation, the D word. Seem to remember that well in 2008 as well as 1929 through the 1930s. It's almost a worst world scenario, but what I'd really like for people to get their minds around is your idea of switching from paper to sound assets. A couple neat little stats I want everyone to remember. There has never really been a time that we can find here, and I have to thank Cliff Asness and Dr. Fama, University of Chicago, for these numbers. Cliff Asness, if you want to invest right, read his stuff. That there has never been a time where you saw the price to earnings on the CAPE ratio, okay, something like 25, and historically it's 15, 16, 17. So we're way out there in valuations, if you want to use valuation metrics. But then we're way off the charts in bond land, too. What I suspect is all these buybacks by corporations, which has been, I think, the rocket fuel underneath this market, is starting to dry up because the debt is now becoming a burden and it's harder to borrow. So you add that into the mix and you could, and keep in mind, these 80th percentile on both stocks and bonds, you can go to 95th percentile or you can go to 100. We're entering just a time where valuations are so extended, and this is the crux of it, with bonds and equities. That has, according to their work, never happened before. And I'm just, again, I return to your concept. We need to be thinking about switching from overvalued paper assets and thinking more about the return of our money and not on our money in sound hard assets.
That's exactly where our thinking is. And by the way, you know, an expensive CAPE ratio makes sense if and only if you have a real solid, compelling story for future growth. We don't have one. We don't have another internet. There's no technology coming along that we can point to. The only thing fueling this so-called growth has been deficit spending, monetary printing, corporate buybacks. It's paper games. So the first thing anybody who's buying super expensive financial assets, be those stocks or bonds, needs to ask is, where's the future growth going to come from? We are 10 years into subpar economic growth for the world. My work on resources explains why that's not just a temporary 10-year hiccup, but a rather permanent condition. Our stock market and bond markets are priced as if not only is that not true, but we're about to return to explosive growth. So it's really on the bulls to answer this question. Where's that growth going to come from? What's the driver? Let me know, because I'm searching for it.
I think it's such an important question. As we pointed out, look, valuations are extended. Then what's going to move us beyond it? Well, they can't buy many more of their shares back. They don't have the funds to do that. Bonds are pricey. You're going to earn 1% on your money for how long, you know, or less, a negative rate. Savings accounts, there's a lot of talk about switching into negative territory there. You know, so we'll hold your money for a price. I'll give you my money and I'll pay you for the privilege. We're entering a time where what will be the driver of these earnings, the engine of growth in not only the economy, but the corporate engine, you know, where does that come from? And of course, yes, there can always be another internet or, but I would also point out that Moore's Law has really come, which is hard for me to believe, to a screeching halt in recent years. And I wonder if history won't look back on this time, say, you know, well, they hit that brick wall with silicon and it really took 5 or 10 years until they developed DNA computing and things of that nature, which is photon computing and whatnot. But I mean, until they reached that level, you know, Moore's Law couldn't continue. And much of our growth has been based on increases in productivity due to technology. Dr. Chris Martinson, what you want to get for this holiday for everybody? Well, here is his magnum opus, Prosper. Tell us a bit more and any other contact information, please.
I'd be happy to. So Prosper, the subtitle is How to Prepare for the Future and Create a World Worth Inheriting. We're at a period of time where all you have to do is just crack a newspaper and you can read about disappearing frogs, soil being destroyed, aquifers going away, geopolitical tensions, oil is getting harder and harder to find. We're going from 7 to 9 billion people. China's buying resources all over the world. What's going on? Prosper is the companion to the Crash Course, which explains why this is all happening. We've got some context for it. We're not surprised by the low growth at all. This is actually well within our prediction set. So that's the problem definition in the Crash Course. Prosper's the solution set. It says, look, given all of that, how are we going to respond? How do we want to be? This is not about being afraid. It's not about thinking you're going to survive when everybody else dies. This is actually about how to be engaged and resilient, how to really bring things into your life that are going to help you today and be potentially lifesavers tomorrow. And so we're very pleased with this book. It represents 6 years of giving seminars and gathering data off our websites and finding out what works and what doesn't work. And so it really is a great gift. You know, people who've read it have said, listen, I'm giving this to people I know who aren't on board yet because this is just so well framed and it's just so lovingly put together and it's just really speaking to people where they really are. It's not trying to convince them the world's ending or any of that stuff.
Don't we have enough doom and gloom in our ears already and fear-mongering? What we need are tangible, empirical, real, down-to-earth solutions to problems that we're facing today. I mean, look at the numbers. I mean, to listen to Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, he just didn't sound like a former government official with this amazing CV and track record and all of these accolades and awards. He really just drove home the dilemma, the disaster that the middle class is facing today, and not just in America, but in the Western world. That's why I think, you know, Prosper and this type of thinking, this type of movement is so important because we need tangible solutions. We don't need theory. We don't need hyperbole. We don't need theoretical constructs. We need something tangible that we can hold in our hand and work through this mess we're partially responsible for, but we've also inherited. What a great discussion. We're going to look forward to having you back on the show, sir.
Well, thank you very much.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.